Welcome to a special edition of the Almost Reckless podcast. I'm your host, Amy Smilovic, and I'm here today with my co-host, Gabriel Smilovic. And our guest is Ken Wallen, artist, entrepreneur, psychologist, and my father. It's going to be a great one.
We're recording.
Okay.
All right. I am here with my dad and my son, Gabriel. And in 2021, we did a live conversation, Dad.
We did.
It was one of the first that I had done.
Yeah.
And the comments from it were so thoughtful, and people were very touched by the conversation. It was great to hear. It meant a lot to them. And my dad, for a bit of background, we are here in his art gallery on St. Simon's Island, Georgia. My dad is a psychologist. I grew up knowing him as the dad who was a psychologist who was very strict, but very cool.
How did you feel about that? Being grounded for 24 hours.
Very differently than I do now, as a mother, especially. So we wanted to interview my dad again, and you're going to hear me referring to him as Dad, and you're going to hear Gabriel referring to him as Pa. And we're going to have a conversation with Dad, Pa, about what it means to take risks and do big things in life. And I think with that, we'll get started.
Yeah. I mean, where do you want to start?
Why don't you introduce yourself first?
Okay. And
let people know what you're doing here.
I'm Gabe, Gabriel. I started it to be about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years, I think, September of 2023. And I manage our new media projects and our partnerships and collaborations, for the brand.
Great.
Yeah.
And what I'm excited about having Gabe here about is when we talk about taking risks in life, so often risks are relative, right? Like some people see what I do, moving to New York, starting a company, as risky. But there's a skydiver out there who takes risks I can't even imagine. And I'm always curious about how we define taking risks and seeing it through our own lens. Because, Dad, you and Mom, you were a psychologist working in just outside of Chicago. Mm-hmm. You were raising us. You had two little kids.
We were in Chicago with a very high rate of crime and social problems.
Yeah.
I'm from a very small town, and you're not accustomed to that lifestyle, and all of a sudden you're thrown into it. So it was a big change.
And this is the 1970s,
mm-hmm.
right? And my sister and I are 7 years old and five, and you decide to pick up and move us to St. Simon's Island, Georgia.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, that was a risk. But, you know, that old saying that if you keep doing the same thing over and over again and complaining about the results you get, and you just keep repeating the same things, then nothing's going to get better. So we were faced with a very cold climate and congestion. And I'm from a small town, and now and then I like to run into somebody I know. And in Chicago, that didn't happen. I don't think that ever happened. So we decided to improve our lifestyle, and we were going to move south. And we got in the car and put the kids in the car and just headed out. We were going to explore. This was like a vacation for us, but it was kind of an exploration. And we ran upon this island, St. Simon's Island, just off the coast of Georgia. And I got a lead from Savannah that they had a job opening down here.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down, had my interview, and spent a night on the island, and we thought, this is it. This is us. And it had really worked out, and there was no guarantee that the funding was going to continue with my job. I had a secure practice up in Chicago and making much better money. But it was worth the risk to come down here. And if it didn't work out, I always had that feeling in life that then something else will. Mm-hmm. Something else will come along. There just was a sense of hope with me that something will work out. I just always remember that about me, that it will work out. And it did. But if it didn't, we would have had another plan.
Where was the funding coming from?
Oh, from the State Department and the government. A little from the government. But funding was an issue every year.
For your jobs, yeah, and education.
This is for severely troubled kids. And it is a part of funding that a lot of people don't realize that we really need this, because they're only visible if they commit a crime.
Yeah.
They don't see the depression, and it's the silent killer. And you just kind of fade into the network, and all of a sudden you're dead by the age of 35, and you're on the news. And how did that happen? Gee, how'd they slip through the cracks? We hear that all the time about, you know, the use of guns in our country and the shootings, and how do these people slip through the cracks like that? You know, they should have been identified early on. Well, that's what that funding is for. And it's always a fight, and it always will be a fight, to create the funding for this part of the population.
So when you and Mom came down here, you knew there was a job that...
Yeah,
was going to be important to you, and that was being funded at the time. How much, where did you get pushback from? Did you get pushback from family? What are you doing? How could you? Oh. Like, was your mom all game for this?
My hometown. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it's like the earth is flat, and I am going to drive right off that cliff. And I'll never forget announcing my family, because this is a farm community, railroad, working in the railroads, working in the steel mills. It was a really working class family, and very close knit, and very few people left home. If they did leave, it was like 60 miles away.
And this was Chesterton, Indiana. Chesterton, Indiana. A couple hours from Chicago.
Right, Chicago, but still, it was very close.
Yeah.
And we were at a family get together, and they were asking me about St. Simon's.
How was your vacation?
And one of my aunts said, "Well, do you have to airlift food in?" No. And I realized, you know, I'm going to have to do a lot of explaining here about where I'm going and the network they have. I'm going to be safe in this kind of business. So there was that kind of dialogue. My family did not take it well. But we left. I am stubborn about these things. I make up my mind, and I'm going to do it, and then I'm going to do it. And so far, things have worked out.
What was there anything that they could have said to you that would have made you and Mom say, "We'll stay"?
No.
Right. You made up your mind.
I had already made up my mind. I didn't discuss it with them and say, "What do you think?" I would. And this is the way I tackled many things. I would decide beforehand and then announce it.
Yeah.
And, you know, does that work for you? It worked for me, but someone else, it may be something you need to run by your loved ones a lot. So I think
ran it by Mom. That's the thing, though. You know, like, it was you and Mom were rock solid on this. Oh, I think had you and Mom not been rock solid on it, that would have been...
Making major decisions has always been a group project with us. We like the idea of no surprises.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't like surprises. So people need to know things beforehand and then plan. But she was on board. She liked a warmer climate, smaller.
If you don't like surprises, but...
But he's spontaneous. You're spontaneous.
Yeah, you're moving to St. Simon's.
Well, by surprises, is me walking home one evening and saying to my wife,
"I'm leaving.
We're leaving.
Or we're leaving.
Pack the bags." That would be a real hurdle that I would have to go through with my wife. And so we got accustomed to not things being thrown at you like that. Now, I'm going to take up a new sport or something like this. You know, I don't go home and, what do you think, honey? We're going to be into bowling now.
That's spontaneous. Yes, yeah.
You know, and you, yeah, and you're going with me. I got lessons set up for you. You know, that never works.
So one of the things that we hear on these podcasts that we've been doing is that we've been speaking with a lot of entrepreneurs, and we find that conviction and passion for something is really important. And the other thing that people talk a lot about is in business what they refer to as your break-even analysis. You know, what is that line that you've got to stay above in order to feel like, ah, oh, okay. Not necessarily that I'm making it, but I'm on my way. And you said that for you, you had family back home. So I guess your break even was if just there was no funding and there was no way to put, like, not putting food on the table, was that, that would have been a deal breaker, right? If you just physically weren't able
facing
to,
poverty. Yeah. That's a real deal breaker. But I don't think I would have moved away from a warmer climate. I think Judy and I agreed that that's part of our lifestyle would not be to go through these winters.
Mm-hmm.
And it just was important to us. And I like sunlight and I like to be out. I like, I'm athletic and I like to do things. So it's better for our lifestyle. So I would have really explored another alternative in a warmer climate before I would have gone back up north. I love the work up there. It was a great working environment. It's very interesting and challenging. Cultural interests were wonderful, great restaurants. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's great, but it was those winters.
Yeah.
And I have arthritis and cold weather plays havoc with me.
And you had arthritis in your 20s and 30s.
Yeah, so I was diagnosed when I was 20.
Yeah.
I was hospitalized for 10 days with an arthritic attack. So it wasn't something that I'm casually throwing out there. It was an issue with mm-hmm. me. And when it's cold, I just stiffen up and it hurts, and came down here and the sunlight and warm weather, and I was much better. I still have arthritis, but it was much better than living in cold.
So that's something too, is really not just knowing your break even, but knowing what your non-compromises are.
Yeah. I think there's this idea actually from Isabella's dad about having your circle of control, and kind of looking at life as, what can I focus on that's within the circle of control that I can actually affect, and then what are things that I have to just let go. And I think that a lot of, like, this pursuit of happiness and breaking even is deciphering what are those things within my circle of control that I can affect, and then allowing those things in the circle to have their impact on that which is outside. So in this case, you know, cold weather is something that you can change. I think that probably the hardest thing is kind of just recognizing, like, the free will to just actually be able to get up and move and go somewhere. What I think maybe what's an interesting question and point to chat about is, what gets in the way of people recognizing that free will, that you can get up and go and change your life, change your conditions, change those things that are within your circle? What is preventing people from seeing that and recognizing those things?
That's a good point, Gabe. You know, in reference to my family, I was just on the fringe of a different way of looking at things. My aunts and uncles and immediate family stayed there. They didn't have that luxury of being able to pick up and move. So you didn't.
Was it a financial issue, or your?
It was just family life. Yeah. And that when you grow up, you kind of move maybe 60 miles away, but that's enough. And when you had get-togethers, you showed up.
But your uncle joined the circus in Florida.
That was, now that's my dad's family.
Okay, got it.
And they're different.
Uh-huh.
And really interesting. And I got to meet the one that joined the circus. He was a real interesting guy. He moved to Florida. And of course, it's outrageous. He moved to Florida. I mean...
And this would have been the 30s, 40s?
Yeah.
But Dad, but ostensibly they're both from the same, they're living in the same region. Now, your dad's family, they were immigrants from Sweden.
Sweden, yeah. They came over on the boat.
Right.
Dad's parents.
Grandma's family, I guess, had been a generation in the U.S. already. Maybe, less risk takers? Were they, because...
Well... When Dad would tell me about his life, I mean, he had to leave home when he was 14 because the farm couldn't support the whole family. And that's not an uncommon thing back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so you left. And he's 14, and he goes to Michigan and gets a job in the steel mills and is a welder and climbing up on these open hearth stacks, you know, with a belt on. And safety is an issue, but you still have to do the job.
Yep.
And he did that for 2 or 3 years. And then he went back home and he worked on the farm again. And then he's on the farm. And then he gets trips and falls underneath this big rototiller and came this close to losing his life. And he had these stories about, you know, being dead because of the work that you had to do. And he had a mindset. You know, I'm living in his household now, and he's taking care of me, and the bills are paid, and I get to go to college, and I don't ever remember being hungry. We had a garden in the backyard, fresh vegetables.
I love that garden.
And it was a great life. And then I hear him that he's out of the house at 14, and I'm, 15 years old when he's telling me this story, and I'm worried about our next basketball game, and am I going to start? That was my big worry.
Right.
And it put things in perspective. So when I talked to him about...
Did Grandpa put that in perspective, or was that a perspective that you got later on?
No, yeah, it's my perspective.
Yeah.
He was just talking about his life, and it wasn't anything... unusual saying I had to leave when I was 14 because it happened to a lot of his people.
Yeah.
So to me, you know, risk-taking, going to college, I didn't know anybody. I went more than anybody else in my social circle. I went the farthest away, didn't know anybody. And he was thinking, and you're worried about what?
Mm-hmm.
And so...
So Grandpa was very encouraging of you going out.
Yeah,
even
when I left, he was still like, "Go for it," you know. He was the one that recognized the need to move around and change,
which was very unselfish because Grandpa, for you guys, he was 17 years older than my grandmother. So Grandpa turned 81 when I was in third grade. I remember that birthday. So. He knew that time was limited, and he still said, go, like, do your thing.
Time was limited in what sense?
Meaning that, you know, as you get older, you start, each year is more and more precious, and your child now and your grandchildren are going to be moving away, and selfishly, I'd want them close by, but he said, go.
It's interesting when I go back to my hometown, which is a town of about 5,000 and one stoplight, one police car. And I go to the reunions of my high school, and I would say 80% haven't moved away.
Mm-hmm.
They're within a 60 miles radius. And I was the one that left.
Is there a lack of desire to leave, or
part of it is a cultural thing? They're very close-knit community, Gabe, so everybody knows everybody, and if you do something different, everybody knows about it, and so that's a strong force. So you just have to be willing to. be stubborn about it, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to see what's on the other side of that hill. But that was always, you know, I hopped in a car and I went to California. I hopped in my car and I went to Florida, and I wasn't with anybody but me. And there wasn't anybody doing that for my hometown. And I just liked to explore. I wanted to find out what California was like, or driving through the desert. I've heard stories about how hot it gets or how cold it gets at night, and the desert's really beautiful, but I'd like to see it.
I think what's important to distinguish, just for anyone listening, is that there are people who stay in that environment and they thrive in that environment. They love it, right? So really, I think what is important is for those who are finding themselves in environments that they don't feel like they're thriving in, they're laying in bed at night thinking, what can I do to make me happier?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I want to qualify my answer to that. My friends back home, they're very happy.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what it's about.
They were very happy. And I was very happy. So it's just a different way to go in life. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought that out.
Because it's diagnosing where your angst or your unhappiness is coming from, and then zeroing in on it, and then being able to do something about it. And I mean, you are a psychologist. You've worked with people for decades on this.
I tell you, one real risk I took, that was my first job out of high school. I had the summer trying to make some money to go to college, and I got a job on the ore boats on Lake Michigan and Lake Superior and Lake Ontario. And I thought, this is really cool. I'm going to be on this ore boat. Never done anything like that. And this was serious. You're on the boats, and they're huge, and you're off for 2 weeks at a time. And your job is to clean the deck. And I'm thinking, the Great Lakes, how rough can it be? It's like being on the ocean. You just cannot believe it. And they had a lifeline from one end of the boat to the other. And if you were going down the deck, you had to grab that lifeline, and you better attach yourself to it or you're going to be gone. And then when you're in Lake Superior, if you fell in, you had about 12 minutes to be rescued. And if that wasn't it, then you're toast. So it was a part of my life that all of a sudden I had to really take things very serious about how I conducted my behavior, being safe and planning ahead and think about life jackets and being where I should be. And then when the ship put into harbor, my job was to take these big pulleys and put them on these posts so they would pull the boat along and the pulleys could snap. So you had to be very aware of any kind of malfunction with the pulleys. And they're telling me this. I'm thinking of, you know, flipping hamburgers during the summer at the dunes, and whether I'm, you know, getting my quota of burgers fried and being nice to the customers, to that. That was an eye-opener.
What I love, though, that Gabe brought up was that when you think about what you want in life and you equate it then to what you can control and then you zero in on that, I hadn't really thought about it through the lens of control, because Frank and I talk a lot about at Tibby drilling down to first principles and really knowing what's important to us. And I think what you're making me think about, Gabe, is that when you drill down to first principles, it's one thing. But when one of our first principles was agency, Frank and I and Elaine, our president, we believe that staying independent is critical and that we never want anyone else to be making decisions for us. And it's a desire that is within our control. We can sell ourselves or we can stay independent. And if we sell ourselves, we would have to recognize that we are losing something that is truly important to us. Yet so many entrepreneurs make the decision to sell when they know that agency is one of their most important needs, and that it was is within their control to keep it. It may not, you have to compromise in other areas to keep it, but when you recognize that that's your most important need, just like the sunlight, it is in your control to get it. When you guys were talking about moving to St. Simons, and Mom was very much part of this discussion, what else were the needs that you guys had that were, because I think time with family had to have been up there.
Yeah, that just occurred to my mind that when I was living in Chicago, I was working 3 nights a week, 6 days, and I wasn't having a lot of time with you. And I did not like that. That's not the kind of dad I wanted to be. So coming down here, we had the luxury of you being able to go outside and play, even when the sun was going down. As long as I could hear your voice out there, I knew you were safe. We wouldn't do that in the part of Chicago I was living in.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just something to adapt and survive. You just had to be persevere with security. So we got to play tennis together. I got to go to all your recitals, all your things that you did after school. And we used to take walks together. And that's when you and I would talk. And it was always better when we walked and we would talk. So I just wouldn't have time for that. And I had to give all that up. So I knew that ahead of time. So, you know, there's one thing I wanted to mention about this making decisions and risk-taking. I always wondered, how do you know that this is a good idea? You know, this is going to be a change, and I'm thinking about this, but I don't know. It's going to disrupt my family, or maybe I'm going to do something different vocationally. How do you know? And I don't know where this came from, but I don't know if it came from a therapist, a psychologist, or what. But he said, if you wake up, and most mornings you think about doing whatever you've been thinking about, and it just keeps coming up, it's probably a good thing to really consider doing this. And I remember telling Judy, we first got married, this was a month after we were first got married, and we were not wealthy, put it that way. I said, I want to live by water. I want to be an artist. I want to have my own studio. And that's not financially feasible when you're just starting out. And she patted me on the back, and she was nice about it. She goes, in your dreams, not now. She said, well, that's a good idea, but maybe we'll work on that.
Yeah.
And
but it's a goal.
But it was a goal. And I would talk about it frequently and then take a few art lessons and take a workshop or something like that, or we take a vacation and we would incorporate painting with that. Is still part of my life.
Were you anxious not doing it all right away?
Well, when I quit my job as a psychologist.
In Chicago or here?
Here, after 27 years. And I've been planning this for a long time, and I was going to do this full time. And then I had the time. And I still had a little practice doing therapy, still taught, you know, doing things to bring in some income and kind of being cautious about this. And guy came by that I was consulting with, and he said, you know, if you're going to really do this, you have to quit doing all this other stuff. And he said, you got to do this full time, and you just got to stop. And that made a lot of sense to me. So I had a woman who drove a pickup, and I said, I'm going to hire you, and I want you to come to the house, and I want you to pick up everything that has to do with psychology and work books and papers and things like that. We're going to get rid of it. And it took her 3 trips. That's a lot of stuff. And I had all these books I was going to write and never got to it, and all these manuals and everything. and stuff I had for workshops, materials, posters, and handouts, and things like that. If I wanted to give a workshop on life skills, things like that. And the last load she drove away with, I thought, oh my God, what have I done? What have I done?
So that really, I have a question. When he said, you have to commit, was it commit because you'll never have time to do it all? Or was it commit because you will never be successful unless you fully focus all your passion and let that come through in what you're doing?
Lo and behold, now I've got the chance to do this. Now's a chance to find out if I'm any good. Mm-hmm. And that scared the pants off me. Was I really just daydreaming and having a fling at this because it was interesting to talk about? Or was I really going to give myself a shot at this? And maybe I'm just not, or maybe mediocre. And that, Amy, that was the scary part of it. And then I set up full time, got it all set up, and 9/11 happened in Chicago, which everything shut down for 4, 5, 6 months. It was what, 2000?
2011? Yeah, we were in
2001.
We were in New York. Gabriel was in the back of the car when the towers
so I had down. My gallery, you know, my easel set up, everything ready for business, and I didn't see anybody for 4 months. Mm-hmm. Everybody ducked their heads in like turtle. And so I had plenty of time to paint, but I weathered that storm. And Judy was supportive, you know, just, you can do it. Like, what have you done? But I just persevered. And I think just being a little bit stubborn about it, I'm not going to give up. I'll show them.
I'm watching Gabriel's, your brain has got to be just crazy right now with what you want to do in life.
It can be super difficult, I think, to be able to control and kind of suppress wanting to be able to do everything that you want to do right now. You know, I want to go back into the hospitality industry at some point. Every day I'm thinking about what that could look like. Is that a restaurant? Is that a wine bar? Every day I'm also thinking about music. Every day I'm also thinking about writing and how do I want to continue writing throughout my career? It kind of goes back to like the circle thing, because this happens all the time, but if I let myself spiral, then there's no creativity that can happen. Like the brain kind of just is so overwhelmed with all these different things that you can't focus on any one thing and actually create anything. You kind of just like pull back into this shell of like doing something maybe like 20% of the way. And I think that everyone, I'm kind of curious, because I think that everyone has moments throughout their life, no matter how old you are, that were significant moments, typically probably not in your favor, not something that was enjoyable to go through, but it taught you that you don't have control over everything all the time. And so you need to be able to relinquish that control and kind of move with the flow of life and what's being handed to you. And then B, that you, once you come out of it on the other side, you have this newfound confidence to be able to.
So there's a good point, Gabe. I've known you, of course, since you were born, and you are a creative individual, always have been. But this was explained to me by a psychologist, therapist, who had written books and he used to consult with me at the program that I ran. And he found out I was an artist, and he said, yeah, it figures. He said, you know, let me tell you a little bit about the creative mind. You want to do everything. And I did. I wanted to write. I wanted to speak, do workshops. I wanted to paint. I wanted to play the guitar. I was going to be a musician. I do all this stuff. And it was fun trying all this stuff. But, you know, as I got older, and by older I mean in my early 50s, I came to realize that I really had to narrow my focus. I mean, it took me that long, Gabe. And I was able to hang on to trying all these things because I had an income. Judy had an income. So we had a life and some financial security. So it was fun to try all these things. But that's when I decided to give that, but I'm just talking about me now, to give that up. And I think that's,
it can
be so rewarding not to give that up, to try all this stuff. If you can financially do it.
Also, there's a mental aspect to it, I think, of like doing all of these things. I think there's an element where it can become really easy to start to view your past endeavors and the things you've done throughout your life as disappointments. Because, at least for me personally, whenever I do something, and this is for better or for worse, but like when I played tennis when I was younger, like I wanted to win all four Grand Slams. And then when I started playing golf, I wanted to win all the majors. And then when I was a cook, I wanted to be the best chef in the world. And DJing, photography, writing, all of these different things, like you kind of attack it with the desire to be the best that there possibly ever was. And in that, it's good because it gives you drive. But then for a long time, I looked back and I was like, wow, I'm a disappointment. Like I didn't go and win four Grand Slams, or I left the kitchen after a year. And it was, but then, you know, like I wrote this on my Substack, and I don't know where this kind of thought came from. It was spurred by a quote, and I can't remember what quote it was right now, but I kind of said that, you know, looking back at all those things, I think if you can reframe the perspective from I wasn't good enough to do that, or I couldn't do it, to I just didn't want to. Because I think at the end of the day, everyone is capable of doing anything and whatever they want to be to do. If you like, you can do whatever you want, you can do anything. And given that notion, that would mean that if you can't do something, then it's because you didn't want to. And it's maybe couched under this idea that like you can't. But if you look back, if I think if anyone like looks back at periods of time in their life, any time that they actually really wanted something, they got it. They figured out how to do it. You figured out how to get to that point.
I think though, what's interesting, and I'd love the luxury of having this talk in 40 years and that you're still here. But Dad, when you talk about those things that you had to just kind of cut loose on those so you could focus on here, you have become an artist in a completely unorthodox way. And I think that had you become the artist that you thought you wanted to be in your 20s, I think you'd be disappointed. And I'm looking around your studio and I see the books that you have written about art. I know the videos that you create teaching people about art. I know the trips that you take photographing things to talk about the animals and life, you know, the environment that you're passionate about with art, the music that you play every time you do a story, it's got to have the right music. Every single thing about your life has culminated into this artist that you've become.
Right.
So you were on that trajectory. You were building the resume for it. And I think that one of the things I find when I talk to people is they really bifurcate their life. They say, I want to become this. And in the meantime, I will do this, this, and this. And then one day I will become this. And they don't realize that, like a Seurat painting, these are all these dots that are going up onto that painting. And when you're up close, it looks like dots.
I have a good quote, because I've been thinking about this a lot, and I've been kind of rereading a lot of David Foster Wallace. And, you know, I think that I have a lot of friends, and we know a lot of people who deal with this kind of idea of, I have to follow these paths, like this regimented path to get to this ultimate goal, and not recognizing that that job as a cook, or that job as a Uber driver, or that job at the convenience store, like all these different things give you different perspectives and different experience from which, and you build your life. And the quote from David Foster Wallace is, it's kind of a critique of the U.S. I don't know when he wrote this, but he says, the U.S. of modern a sloppy intersection of desires and fears, where only public consensus is a boy must surrender to the acknowledged primacy of straight line, pursuing this flat and short-sighted idea of personal happiness. And it's, and David's words are so genius, but, you know, he applies this kind of twofold notion of you follow this straight line consensus pursuit. It's flat and it's short-sighted, and it's both the trajectory of your life and ultimately the result of the type of happiness that you end up having is the same as the outcome of the happiness of the trajectory of your life is relevant and related to the trajectory and the bumps and the highs and the lows and how straight that trajectory was.
I personally think it's sad that he saw that, you know, life in that way. And I think that it's, that to me is what is so incumbent upon all of us, is to debunk that myth that there are experts of industries, there are experts of life, that there are, you know, that 1 + 2 will always equal 3 in a straight path to a successful career, or then the career equates happiness. I think it is really getting people to go from A to 1 to Z to 3, like moving around and collecting these things to build their picture.
We have three different generations right here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think part, at least from what my experience is like part of growing up and getting older is kind of recognizing that no one actually knows anything at the end of the day. I mean, obviously people have wisdom from their experiences, and, you know, you touch a hot pan and you're not going to touch that pan again, but there are so many unknowns in life that, you know, I mean, I don't know. As you've gone throughout life, obviously you've had more experiences, but, you know, I'm curious what it feels like to be at the stage of life that you're at now.
I'm 81, so that's a good question. What's it like when you are in your 80s as opposed to being in your 60s or 40s or starting out?
20s.
And it's different. And a lot of my life right now I conduct based on my memories. I'm not having these new experiences. I'm not going to climb Mount Everest. I'm not going to go down the Amazon and swim with pink porpoises and things like that. If I paint outside, I'm not going to go to some snow-capped mountain in Colorado and paint snow, which younger artists do. So it is a something that you can say, oh, poor me, or I can relish painting my memories, and can I express them in a different way? So I am painting, enjoying combining fantasy with realism, abstraction with realism. I'm looking at a painting right now of an octopus that's made up of all the friends that octopus have, clownfish, other octopus, squids, sea turtles, and forming an octopus. It's a way to celebrate the animal. And I used to scuba dive quite a bit, and that's what I saw, but I never combined them all together. So it's a great memory for me. Now, whether or not it's a good painting or someone will buy it, that's kind of secondary. But that's one way that age has affected with the kind of work I do. Probably the biggest impact. But, you know, I wanted to switch something, Gabe. You said a significant comment about control and how important that is, but sometimes you have to let go. And I've been teaching art for quite a while, and one common thread I see with young artists or people who haven't had a lot of experience with it is the need for control, and they use it in their life all the time. They're selling real estate, they're a vice president of a bank, or dealing with other people's money, and it takes a lot of discipline and control to do that job. And then they want to take up painting, and to start a painting out, you have to let go of control. You're just letting paint fly and move around and feelings. And it's like, we need to go for a long walk and talk about this before you even pick up a paintbrush.
Do you think that, like, do you think that a long walk can possibly, I guess where I'm going with this is, I think that the best way to learn how to lose control is to have control taken from you, from an outside source.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious if that is actually necessary. Like you actually have to go through periods of time where control has been taken.
I'll tell you what I do. When I set up my lessons, I put a timer. And I say, you're going to start a painting and you've got 5 minutes to create an image. And you cannot dilly-dally around. You've got to get to work. And you won't have time to think. You just have to do. And that's one of the best exercises I can do with them. And you would be surprised how upset people get about that timer. They want to have time to plan and think and organize, because that's the way they conduct themselves all day long. And it's one reason they've been successful in life. And now I'm asking not to kind of throw that out the window. And so there are things that you can do, like taking a walk. I like to go get a cup of coffee and look at the ocean and just watch birds and hear the sound of waves. And that helps loosen me up.
What were some moments in time where you lost control, whether sickness, health, outside events, nature, catastrophes, that you were able to, maybe not exactly in the moment, but kind of realize, okay, this is a situation where I can't do anything about this?
In my work as a psychologist, there were situations that people were in that they would tell me about that was very upsetting, and I saw very little hope, that there wasn't anything that I could do about as a therapist. If you are on drugs, and you are still on drugs when you come and see me, there isn't anything I can do to help you. The only way that I can help you in a therapeutic situation is for you to get off the drugs. And if they weren't willing to do that, if they wouldn't go into treatment, there isn't anything I could do. And when I started out, I thought I was going to help everybody. And that's not the case.
But Dad, there was one time that I think would maybe get to to something interesting here is I always knew you as the most upbeat, optimistic person, always. But around 2000s, early 2000s, that changed. And I remember I was like, Mom, Dad's not himself. And she said, I know he's having to now for his work, they're making him drive an hour each way. He's got a 2-hour commute. There were some issues with some, you know,
this
thing, people.
How I handled that. I just didn't do it.
But that's a situation where you had really, you had all of your rules broken. Someone really took control and you decided to walk away.
Yeah.
And so it was a bad situation and you didn't try and fix that situation. This was when you were like, this is a turning point for me. This is a sign.
Yeah, and I tried a lot of new things, and it forced me to be a speaker to 500 people, scared to death of talking in front of that many people. So I did. It really got me out of my comfort zone.
Is that bad? If that bad situation had not happened,
I wouldn't have been.
You may not have.
No,
been here. You know, you could have maybe been content, and you know, it forced something on you, as painful as it was at the time.
So I took the anger that I felt and I channeled it into my work, and I worked harder, longer, and I was mad. And then as I studied the problem, this happens to a lot of people in the work environment. And I, you know, was able to move away from poor me and this happened to me. It happens to a lot of us. And there was, you mentioned looking at a quote, Gabe, there was one quote that I liked, that the definition of who you are is when you are falling flat on your face. What you do, that's who you are. And so I fell flat on my face, and the definition of me was, what am I going to do? How am I going to deal with this and be resilient and change it? And if you win the race, if you win the tennis tournament and you're the best, that's not hard to take. Anybody, let's go out to dinner. Let's celebrate. That's easy. It's when you lose, and maybe not only lose, but lose badly. I can think of every game I play. I played basketball in college, and I can remember being horrible. I don't remember the great games. I remember the stinkers. And bad reviews and criticism. So that always, you know, and it gets to that. It's almost a cliche anymore, but we learn more from our failures than anything else. So go out and fail.
The cliches happen for a reason, because there is such a truism to it.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, back to that control issue. I don't want to pass that off lightly. It's something that being able to pull back and let go of needing to be control everything is really important to do. And we all fight that. It isn't something that, oh, well, they're able to do that, then I'm not. No, we all struggle with that. And it's a continuous problem. And even though I put timers on other people, I'll put timers on myself, or I'll put on a series of music, and I know it's got 4 plays, and I've got that much time to get this done on the canvas. So no more coffee breaks, just paint and stop thinking and just feeling and see what happens. And then bring out your...
How much is not... Because I think that this is another thing, an interesting point that I may or may not have written about yet, but the balance of thinking and doing, and where thinking gets in the way of actually being able to do.
Well, let's say, okay, in a painting, it's no thinking, and that's 30% of the painting.
See, because I also think, like, in writing, it's no thinking.
Exactly right. I was just going to mention that,
Which
too. I'm glad you brought that up.
Contrary.
Same principles across the board on any creative thing you're going to do. But I think that's hard.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I realize is a lot of people are hung up on those who are able to intuit and those who aren't. And either intuition is something that you're born with or you do not have intuition. And one of the things that I found is you can intuit your next step when you're in the middle of the stride. So if you're not actually out there walking, it's impossible to intuit what the next step is if you've never even gotten out of the chair. And I think with writing, you know, when people talk about getting into the flow of painting, of life, it really is about getting into that first step. And that is where I see people consistently having the hardest time, is that first step. And you, there's a million books out there on the 5-page business plan, the 20-page plan, and all this planning. That first step is so critical. You can write your plan at step 3, step 20, but without step 1, there's no point in a plan.
I mean, this is a question that I've just been having, like, conversations with a lot of people about, and I haven't been able to figure it out. I'm thinking about it probably for years now, but it's about, like, whether or not talent is actually a thing. Or at least, the way that I think it's important to note, probably, like, the way that I understand the term talent is that a skill just kind of comes naturally to you. Like, you are able to just sit down at the piano and the notes just flow. And, you know, if someone tells me, like, I think you are a talented writer, you know, I feel like I read 2 hours of, like, hard copy books every day. And if you look at my grammar from third grade, it was atrocious. Like, I had so many issues with my English teachers growing up because, like, I just couldn't write. Or if someone says that, you know, you are talented at cooking, it's like, I cook every single day. I've read, like, hundreds of cookbooks. I watch and listen to hundreds of, like, cooking tutorials and education on it. And so I feel like there's another cliche, but it's like, there is no talent without hard work. I'm just curious how you feel about the word talent. Because for some reason, for me, it has a very kind of negative connotation.
Well, I feel like our perception of talent is way overrated.
And I think that the reason why I have a negative connotation with it is because it is kind of like a cop-out. It's like, oh, they're so talented, mm-hmm. and that's why they're able to be able to, that's why they're able to do what they do.
Therefore,
I could never do that. I'm not talented.
Yeah, so people see my career over the years and they say, well, when did you start drawing? And it was in the fourth grade. And they say, well, you always had that.
Immediately,
right.
They
you know,
give
I
you permission
you
to have been
right.
successful,
right.
yes.
And I tell people that we're all artists and they go, yeah, right. I can't draw a lick or things like that. And here's the difference. We're all artists. That's true. We're all talented. We're all creative. The difference is somebody who is able to achieve at a certain level of painting or writing, here's the difference. They have an uncontrollable urge to do it. They are compelled to paint, compelled to write. They just love it. And that's the difference between a talented person here and a talented person here. Here's a talented person that can write who doesn't do it. And here's a talented person who's a writer and has published books and is really a good writer, is that they are driven to do it.
I think there's one more layer to it. I think that you're okay. So now you are talented enough to write, and then you write, you have to find your people. You have to find your people in life, and you have to find the people who are going to critique you, and it matters. And, you know, for me, as the owner of Tibby, I have had so many designers come in who are absolutely bona fide, talented, incredible creatives, but not right for Tibby. And it's always one of the most difficult things, because you never want to squash that in someone. Someone might be an incredible writer, but how many things do we read from writers that we don't love because it doesn't speak to us? And had that writer come to us as the critic first and been shot down and given up based on my love of whatever, it would have been so wrong. So it's the perseverance to keep doing it, but also the perseverance that when you do it, you keep going until you find your audience that loves it. Because Dad, like, you know, with the paintings behind you, if you were constantly selling to people who only liked Ansel Adam photography, you would feel like a loser. You have to find your people. And I find way too many people put way too much stock and judgment in people who aren't really the ones that they should be judging. And I think it's one good rule of thumb is, if you have an artist whose work you truly admire, not their stature, not how many books they sold or whatever, but who really speaks to you, that's a person who probably you want to say, what do you think of what I'm doing? Because my goal, I want to speak in the way that you do. Am I doing it? What pointers would you have? But don't go, you know, if you're not a thriller, don't go to Stephen King for advice. If you like, you know, writing beautiful, soft love stories, why would you? So I find people try and get validation from the wrong sources, and then they get convinced that they don't have talent.
I think I have something here about good sense. And the general consensus of what good sense is.
Common sense?
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, hopping on a plane and moving to Europe on a whim is not good sense. Not investing in stocks, but instead investing in a set of kitchen knives is not traditional good sense. So
I just think your analogies are pretty apt, knowing you, but yeah.
But if you wake up every other day and think about those kitchen knives,
I mean,
there's something about that that is intriguing to you.
Right. And I think that that's like the point of this is that, you know, what is good sense? Why does the general consensus even exist? Because everyone is so different, and
it's relative. You took all our money and put it into the gas for us to have our summer vacation camping all the way to Chicago. We were broke. It was not good sense to literally use our last dimes for gas to get us on those summer vacations, but you did.
I mean, these are investments. There's a story behind that. These are investments in yourself. I mean, I think some people look, and that's fine. Like, someone looks at NVIDIA stock and, you know, you invest in that and you see that as an investment in your future and yourself right now. I can't do that. I personally look at NVIDIA stock and I'm like, I'm going to waste $800 on this. Why would I do that when I can buy a new camera that will further photography that I'm trying to work on? It's not good or bad, but I think that good sense, following what you think is like the general consensus, can kind of lead down a tricky road, a road that's potentially inhibits you from being able to lean into the things that really truly make you the happiest right now in the present moment and right here. But I think it's always a constant balance of, you know, how do I be as present as possible and be as happy as possible right now, right here, and then not try and think and worry myself about the potential negative impact that being present and happy right now is going to have in 5 years.
I think some of it, and I know that you didn't mean this maybe so literally, but some of it is also just being honest with yourself and then what will make you happy and what you can do in life. And so NVIDIA stock, for example, I think a lot of us say, oh my God, I was going to invest in NVIDIA stock and I didn't. And now it's this and it's this and it's this. When you keep a tally of the things that you were going to invest in, write them all down, because you probably were going to invest in four other companies that dived.
Yeah.
You know, and so really in that thing, you're like, thank goodness I didn't invest that day, because while NVIDIA would have done this, the other four would have failed. And, you know, it just may not be in our acumen, because to quote Paul here, he said, movie videos, Blockbuster, who will buy those? No one wants to watch a movie at home. Who would want to see a movie twice?
That'll never work.
That'll never work. And then he said, movies by DVD, Netflix, that will never work. So this hasn't been a strong suit.
I remember thinking, what do they think they're doing? We went by the
video store.
The video store.
Video Schmidio. So, you know, sometimes you almost feel like a failure or a could have been a contender, when really maybe not so much, you know?
One of the things, though, I've seen you do in this, you know, keep this up, and it's very important with this creative mind of yours, Gabe, is try new things. Just keep at it. Experiment. Find out about yourself. What's good, what isn't. Don't get bogged down with, you know, you mentioned you need to be the best. You know, it's good to strive towards something, a certain benchmark, but try new things. You're always going to be learning. And then things will start coming together for you, because you're going to see some kind of consistencies, some things that you thought about years ago and you're still thinking about it. It's kind of formulating some kind of shape for you in your life. And that just comes with time.
That control thing, it's because the two things with control that you said, you said you have to just have control taken from you. But I think also one of the ways that you start to learn to give up control is what Paul's saying, with time. And I think Tracy's a good example at Tibby. She has been in enough situations where we have worked so hard on a runway collection. And at some point, you just have to stop and leave it to fate. Something comes in for the wrong factory, you can lose your shit. But then you find out over time that all those mistakes, actually, either they went unnoticed, or it was like people loved it that the dress had this weird hole in the back or whatever. And you learn that it will all work out in the end. And even when it doesn't work out, even that alone is its own way of working out. But that takes time. It really does. That takes time, but you know, you hit your 50s and this starts to really sink in. It's a good thing.
But with the creative mind, you're probably going to be dealing with this all your life. I do it. And what that psychologist was telling me that consulted with me, he said, that's the blessing of being creative, but it's also the curse. You constantly want to do different things and try new things, and this is interesting and this is interesting.
Never settled.
And it's going to be a battle to narrow things down and stick with one thing. It only took me, 50 years?
I have no memories, Dad. I have no memories of you just laying around.
Not me?
No. Yeah. No, it was tennis. Yeah. Out in the backyard, you know, painting, yeah. Art shows.
I was thinking of that the other day.
No, you know, 6 a.m., everyone up.
Yeah.
Up and at them. exercise.
I was, I worked all through school. I did that. And but I was, my father was like that. He did all kinds of interesting new things. So I had that as a role model when I was younger. He's never made any money at it, but he was always trying to invent new things.
Yeah.
And he seemed relatively happy.
Yeah.
So I've got something new on the cusp that I've been wrestling with that I want to try. It's in the field of creativity. But it's one of those things that I'm thinking, do I really want to do this? It's something I've never done before. And, if it keeps reoccurring when I get up in the morning, if it seems still a good idea, I'll probably invest some money in it and try it. But if it wanes and I lose interest in it, then I know it's something I shouldn't be doing.
And that, I think that's a good thing to end on. That's your indicator that it's not a good thing
For me,
because
that's.
your interest waned rather than other people
Yeah.
not being interested in it
Yeah.
or liking it.
Yeah, just all of a sudden it's 3 weeks and I haven't thought about it. That's not a good thing.
And it's not that you couldn't do it, but you just didn't want to.
Just
Yeah.
It's your life.
was going to put a half effort into it.
Yeah.
And it's going to take about a $1,000 investment for the equipment. And do I really want to do that? Or maybe that would be part of a plane flight to France. I
Exactly.
think I'll do that.
All right.
All right,
Dad,
guys. That
all
was
right.
fun.
So let's not wait another 4 years for the next one.
Yeah, right.
Let's make this an annual
Paul,
thing.
wake up.